Welcome back, everybody, to another deep dive. Today, we're going to be looking at a question that has really plagued scholars for, well, for ages, really.
Yeah.
And that is, did the prophet Isaiah actually write the entire book attributed to him in the Hebrew Bible? We've got a fascinating lecture transcript from Professor Robert Vinoy's Major Prophets class.
Okay.
And let me tell you, this deep dive, it's going to be like a detective story. We've got linguistic clues, we've got historical riddles, all that good stuff.
It's a real mystery. You know, there's this theory called the two Isaiah theory.
Okay.
And it suggests that chapters 40 to 66, which are sometimes called Deutero-Isaiah, weren't actually written by the original Isaiah, but by someone else, maybe even much later.
So we're dealing with, like, a potential case of mistaken identity?
Right.
Or maybe even a literary collaboration across time.
Yeah. Exactly.
So let's look at the evidence. The transcript points to some pretty noticeable differences in language and style and historical context between the first and second parts of the book.
Yeah. One of the first clues in our detective story here comes from word choice.
Okay.
So the word ani, which means I, it pops up way more often in the second part of Isaiah, whereas anoki, which also means I, is more common in the first part.
Okay.
And some scholars, they see this as evidence of language evolving over time, which might point to a later author for that second part.
That makes sense. I mean, language changes, right? I mean, we don't say thou anymore.
Right.
But couldn't there be other reasons for these different word choices? You know, like maybe it's more about what each author was talking about, like their subject matter, rather than when they were writing.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Professor Vinoy and a scholar named Alders, they bring up some interesting counterarguments here.
Okay.
They point out, for example, how the book of Haggai, which was written after the exile, only uses an ani.
Mm.
So if ani is like the sign of later writing, then why is it the only form used in Haggai, this post-exilic book?
Okay, that is a bit of a head-scratcher, for sure.
Right.
It seems like simply looking at which form of I is used might not be enough to really, you know, crack this case wide open.
It's not the smoking gun.
Yeah.
And there's more. The book of Ezekiel, which was written during the exile, uses both ani and anoki. So the shift towards just using ani wasn't a complete thing, even during the exile.
Right. So it sounds like the language trail might be leading us in circles a little bit here.
Yeah, it's tricky.
What other clues can we follow?
Well, despite these differences, there's a really interesting linguistic link between both sections of Isaiah.
Okay.
They share a unique way of saying, thus saith the Lord, a phrasing that you don't find anywhere else in the Bible.
Interesting.
So this kind of common thread, it suggests that maybe we shouldn't be so quick to rule out a single author just yet.
Okay, so we got this mix of differences and similarities in the language.
Right.
Professor Vinoy also mentions the work of Rachel Margoliath, who she really dove deep into the language of Isaiah.
Yeah, Margoliath's research is really fascinating. She meticulously categorized Isaiah by subject, like, you know, how God is described or descriptions of Israel, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Think of her as like a literary detective, you know, dusting for fingerprints.
Okay.
She analyzes how language is used to express different ideas, you know, looking for patterns and stylistic choices.
So instead of just looking at single words in isolation, she's analyzing how language is used to create kind of a stylistic fingerprint.
Exactly. And she found some pretty compelling evidence. Both sections of Isaiah, they use unique expressions and stylistic features that are consistent within the book, but you don't find anywhere else in the Bible.
Okay, give me an example. What kind of unique fingerprint did she find?
Well, for example, Margoliath found 11 different epithets referring to the Jewish people.
Okay.
And these appear in both parts of the book.
Mm.
She also uncovered 20 different introductory formulas, like ways of opening prophecies or emphasizing prophecies.
Mm.
And these have linguistic parallels in both sections as well.
Wow, that is fascinating. It seems like Margoliath's work gives a boost to the single author theory.
Yeah.
But is her research, is it the definitive answer?
Not quite. Even Margoliath acknowledges that her findings don't offer absolute proof.
Right.
But what's crucial is that she shows that linguistic analysis can be used to support either side of the debate.
Okay.
You know, it's not as simple as saying, like, this word equals this time period and that's it.
So the language evidence is kind of a mixed bag, kind of pointing us in different directions.
Yeah.
Where do we go from here? What other clues can we explore to try and solve this authorship mystery.
Well, another major piece of the puzzle is the historical context of each section.
Okay.
You see, the first part of Isaiah focuses on warnings of an impending Assyrian invasion and exile, which is very specific to Isaiah's time. But the second part, it kind of acts as if the exile has already happened. It talks about Babylonian captivity and the rise of Cyrus the Great of Persia.
That's a pretty significant difference. How do scholars make sense of this historical gap?
Well, there are a couple of possible explanations. One, of course, is that Deutero-Isaiah was written by a different author living during the Babylonian exile.
Okay, which would explain the shift in focus.
Exactly.
What's the other explanation?
The second possibility, and this is where things get even more interesting, I think,
okay,
is that Isaiah himself was actually inspired to write about events that were far in the future.
Hmm.
So he wasn't just predicting the immediate future, but he was peering into a time beyond his own lifetime,
right,
offering this message of hope to those who would one day face exile.
So Isaiah might have been some sort of prophetic time traveler.
You could say that, but not all scholars agree.
Right.
A scholar named Y. Bray argues that chapters 40 to 55 would have been totally meaningless to people in Isaiah's time because, you know, Babylon wasn't a major power yet. And Cyrus hadn't even been born.
So Wybrey is firmly in the two-author camp.
Yes. He believes that a 6th-century author writing directly to the exiles in Babylon
mm-hmm.
is the most likely explanation.
Okay.
But then we have scholars like David Noel Friedman who argue that prophecy doesn't always have to be tied to this immediate historical context.
Right. We were just saying how prophets, you know, sometimes write about events far beyond their own time.
Exactly.
It's like they're tapping into a different timeline or something.
Precisely. Friedman points to examples like Zechariah and Daniel, whose writings talk about things that happened long after they were gone.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that Isaiah could have written about the Babylonian exile,
yeah,
even though it hadn't happened yet.
Okay, so we've got linguistic analysis that supports both sides.
Okay.
And we've got a historical context that's really open to interpretation.
Right.
Are we any closer to solving this authorship puzzle?
Well, it seems like we've hit a wall with our traditional detective work here. Yeah.
But don't worry. We have some 21st century tools to help us out here.
Okay. Bring it on. What do we got?
Ah, you're talking about computer-assisted linguistic analysis.
Okay.
It might sound like something out of a sci-fi movie, but it's actually become a valuable tool for analyzing texts and comparing authorship.
So we're bringing in like the digital detectives to help us sift through all this evidence.
Exactly. Think of it this way. These programs can analyze massive amounts of text, you know, looking for subtle patterns in word choice, in sentence structure, other linguistic features.
Okay, so they're like literary bloodhounds sniffing out the clues that we might miss just reading it with our own eyes.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And one of the early pioneers in this field was a scholar named Yehuda Radeh.
Okay.
And he used computer analysis to examine the book of Isaiah.
Okay.
And based on the variations that he found, he concluded that it just couldn't have been written by a single author.
So the computers have spoken,
right,
case closed.
Well, not so fast.
While Radeh's study was really influential, especially among those who already believed in the two-author theory, other computer studies have actually produced different results.
Mm.
Some support a single author for Isaiah.
Okay.
While others point to multiple authors or even different divisions within the book.
So even with our high-tech tools, we're still not getting a clear answer here.
Right. It's complicated.
Why is that? I mean, are the computers just not reliable enough to really solve this debate once and for all?
Well, it's not quite that simple. John Oswald, a scholar who's dedicated a lot of time to studying Isaiah.
Okay.
He raises some really interesting points about these computer analyses.
Okay.
He argues that we might not understand enough about how individuals vary their language over time to really draw firm conclusions from these studies.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like trying to identify an artist based on like a single brushstroke, right?
Yeah.
You need to see their entire body of work to really get a sense of their style.
Exactly. And as Oswald points out, there's a bit of irony in how some scholars have embraced computer analysis mm-hmm. when it, you know, supports their view.
Right.
But they're a lot less enthusiastic when similar studies challenge their assumptions. Mm-hmm. For example, when Radeh used these same methods to analyze the book of Genesis and concluded that it was a unified composition, it didn't get the same level of acceptance from those who had praised his work on Isaiah.
it sounds like there might be a little confirmation bias going on there.
Right.
You know, where people tend to favor evidence that supports what they already believe.
It's definitely something to consider. But ultimately, the most significant piece of evidence in this whole debate might be the lack of manuscript evidence supporting two authors.
Mm-hmm.
The Dead Sea Scrolls, which are, you know, the oldest copies of Isaiah that we have,
right,
they present it as one complete book.
So even with all of our modern technology and centuries of scholarly debate, we're still left with this mystery. There's just no definitive answer to who wrote Isaiah.
It remains an open question, a puzzle that continues to intrigue and challenge us.
Okay, so if we can't say for sure who wrote the book of Isaiah, then why does this whole debate even matter? What difference does it make to our understanding of the text?
That's an excellent question, and it really gets to the heart of why this deep dive is so important.
Okay.
See, the question of authorship has real implications for how we read and understand Isaiah.
Yeah.
If we accept the two author theory, then we might approach chapters 40 to 66 differently, seeing them as the product of a different historical context and possibly a different theological perspective as well.
So it's not just an academic exercise.
Right.
The answer to this authorship question could actually change how we understand the meaning and message of Isaiah.
Precisely. And here's something to consider. The historical context surrounding the book of Isaiah, this could provide some really valuable insights into this whole debate.
Yeah, that's right. We've been so focused on the who that we haven't really talked about the when and the where.
Yeah.
Those factors matter a lot.
They absolutely do. Remember, the world of ancient Israel during Isaiah's time was a turbulent place. It was a nation caught in this constant power struggle, you know, facing threats from empires like Assyria and Babylon.
Right.
Imagine the fear and uncertainty that people must have felt living under this constant shadow of war.
Yeah, so Isaiah wasn't just preaching in a vacuum.
Right.
He was speaking to real people who were dealing with some very real anxieties about their future, about their families, about their very existence.
Yeah, exactly. And those anxieties, those would have shaped how they heard and understood his message.
Right.
For instance, in the first part of the book, Isaiah's warnings about this impending Assyrian invasion, those would have struck a very raw nerve.
Yeah, those warnings weren't just like these abstract theological concepts. You know, they were about real world consequences, about the potential destruction of everything they held dear.
You're right. And this is where the historical context becomes really interesting when we think about the authorship debate.
Okay.
If chapters 40 to 66 were written by a later author, you know, during the Babylonian exile, then it would make sense that the focus kind of shifts to these themes of comfort and hope.
Because those people were already living through the very exile that Isaiah had warned about.
Yeah.
They needed a different kind of message, one that offered solace and the promise of a future restoration.
Exactly. The messages of comfort and the promise of return that you find in Deutero-Isaiah, these would have been a lifeline to those who were struggling to maintain their faith and their identity while living in a foreign land.
Right.
You know, stripped of their homeland and their temple.
It's like those chapters become like a survival guide for,
for
maintaining hope in the face of just overwhelming loss and despair.
Yeah. That's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah.
And it highlights how understanding the historical context can really deepen our appreciation for the power and the relevance of Isaiah's message, whether it came from one voice or from multiple voices across time.
This has been an amazing journey so far. You know, we've explored the two Isaiah theory. We've examined these linguistic clues like detectives. And we've even tapped into the power of computer analysis. And yet the question of authorship remains a fascinating puzzle.
It truly is. And that's what makes studying the Bible so rewarding.
Yeah.
Even without all the answers, this deep dive has shown us the enduring complexity and the power of the book of Isaiah. It continues to spark debate. It inspires reflection, and it challenges us to think critically about the origins and the interpretations of these ancient texts.
So as we wrap up this exploration, we'll leave you with a final thought to ponder. How does your understanding of Isaiah's historical context impact your interpretation of the text? What resonates most deeply with you, given your own experiences and perspectives?
Remember, the Bible isn't just a collection of stories from a distant past. It's It's a living text that continues to speak to us across the centuries, offering wisdom and comfort, challenge and hope for our own journeys. And on that note,
we'll sign off for today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of Isaiah. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep seeking those nuggets of knowledge that make life a little bit richer, a little bit brighter, and a whole lot more interesting.
It really makes you think about how these ancient texts still speak to us today, doesn't it?
They really do. And you know, it reminds us of the Bible. It's not just some dusty old book on a shelf.
Right.
It has this amazing ability to connect with us on a personal level, you know, no matter who we are, where we come from.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of it. You know, it's timeless.
Yeah.
And it speaks to the deepest parts of who we are as human beings.
Well said. And on that note, I think it's time for us to wrap up this deep dive.
Yeah, I guess all good things must come to an end, right?
They do, but the conversation doesn't have to end here.
Right.
You know, we encourage everyone listening to keep exploring, keep digging deeper into the book of Isaiah and really see what other treasures you can uncover.
Yeah, and don't be afraid to ask those tough questions, to challenge those assumptions, to really wrestle with the text.
Yeah, that's how we grow, right?
Absolutely. That's how we learn and how we come to a deeper understanding of ourselves and our faith.
Well said. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of Isaiah. We'll see you next time for another fascinating exploration.